Okay, welcome everybody to today's international guest lecture at ISA, the Institute for Social Anthropology, with Dr. Martin Saxa. The lecture's title you can see here, it's on remoteness and connectivity in the Himalayas. It's a particular pleasure for me to welcome Martin at our institute and in Vienna, which he's visiting for the first time. And to introduce him a little bit to you. Martin is currently based at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich, where he is currently finishing his Marie Curie project titled Neighboring China, and just about to begin his ERC starting grant project called Remoteness and Connectivity, Highland Asia and the World. So I expect that this talk will be mostly about his new project. It's actually hard to do justice to the richness and the quality of Martin's academic life and work, so I'll try my best. Martin received his PhD in 2010 from Oxford University, from the anthropology department there, for his outstanding dissertation on the creation of a Tibetan medicine industry and the moral economy of Tibetanness in mostly the Tibetan Autonomous Region. Which he also published in record time with Berghahn as a book. I guess I don't need to mention that this book is highly influential in the field, and I personally got a lot out of it, and I appreciate it a lot. He's also the author of seven other peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, with several more forthcoming. After his PhD, Martin was a postdoc fellow, first at the University of Oxford and then at the Asia Research Institute at the National University of Singapore, before actually settling down in Munich. Although settling may be too big a word, considering his extensive field work, both in the past and present, in Highland Asia, including in Tibet, the Himalayas, the Pamir Mountains, as well as other parts of Central Asia and Southern Siberia. But there's also another side to Martin's work, which is visual anthropology, and I expect we'll get a glimpse of it today. He's actually the maker of two feature-length documentary films. The first one, or rather the second one, the latest one, called Journeys with Tibetan Medicine, which came out in 2005 and was screened at several movie festivals as well as in Swiss movie theaters, which was about how Tibetan medicine and a particular formula, I think, of Tibetan medicine traveled from Buryatia to St. Petersburg in the West. Highly recommended. The other one is an older one from 2010 called Mosiman, which is on aging, the topic of aging in Zurich's red light district. He also runs a highly recommended visual anthropology blog called The Other Image. If you just Google that, you will find it, which also features excellent photos taken by himself, as well as really incisive text passages. So, Martin, I'm really glad that you're here today, and I'm looking forward to your talk. Thank you.
Well, now you set the bar very high. Thank you for all the flattering. I hope I can live up at least halfway to this, to the expectations raised here. Let me just for a second tell you how I came from Tibetan medicine to what I do now. I had this 10-year interest in the history of Tibetan medicine, and that's also how the two of us got to know each other. But I was always more interested in the social anthropology side, not so much the medical anthropology side of it. And my PhD on the industry of Tibetan medicine was also looking into all these interactions between central Tibet and South Asia, because so many of the herbs used in Tibetan medicine, they come from Nepal, from India. 50% of the species, up to 80% of the volume, actually, is imported from non-Tibetan areas. And looking into these trade relationships, I started getting very interested in these exchanges across the border in China. Because when I met these people doing trade between Nepal and Tibet, they reminded me so much of all these people I met 8 years earlier in southern Siberia, when I was making this documentary on how Tibetan medicine came to the West via Mongolia and Buryatia, my hosts, my friends there, they were in a very similar situation. They kind of were living close to the border of the contemporary People's Republic of China, and they had very similar experiences within, like, starting around maybe the mid-90s and really taking off only over the last kind of 15 years or so. There was this huge boom in China, and that basically triggered some sort of reorientation of many of these people in the Himalayas as well as in Siberia towards China. So this was what led me to this postdoc project of neighboring China, which basically tries to find out what China's rise, as it is often called, means for the people living directly along the borders. This is a large-scale project that I was also cooperating with quite a number of people, and there is a book coming out of this, hopefully this year. And what we were looking at were these processes of exchange that were revived or reinvented over the last 10, 15 years along the borders of China. This is Chinese trucks going into Kyrgyzstan at Torungak Pass in China. So you have all these things in this neighboring China topic. You have the skepticism, the outright hostility sometimes against China and Chinese. You have all these regimes of control that kind of changed over the last 10, 15 years. And for me, it's really one of these hotspots where much of Cold War, of post-Cold War Asian history comes together. So I was trying to look at these border worlds along these 22,000 kilometers of China's land borders with 14 different countries, not as the peripheries at the edge of nation states, but much more as the junctures that hinge Asia together, that hinge contemporary Asia together. In the Himalayas, this has a lot to do with infrastructure, because over the last 10 years, China has invested heavily in the extension and renovation of the road network on the Tibetan Plateau. There are like dozens of new roads and that lead basically from the Tibetan Plateau up to the border with Nepal and India now. So in the northern part of Nepal, you find this reorientation towards China in a very pronounced way. There was this large major discourse that basically with communist China establishing itself more firmly in Tibet at the end of the 50s, that basically these old relations of trade fell in decay and that this old life that was dealing with exchange came to an end for good. And over the last 10 years, you can see that this actually is not true. It has never been completely true, but over the last years, you see this enormous boom that had people really looking back towards these old trade relations with Tibet. So I met people in these northern borderlands of Nepal who left their well-paid jobs in Kathmandu to become roadside traders in a tent somewhere in Arthurumla, as this guy here, reviving all these old trade relations and all these old institutions of, for example, the seasonal trademark, the entrepot in the northern borderlands of Nepal. All the goods you see on the left side in this tent, they come from Xinjiang by rail to Kashgar and then by truck to the Tibetan border, carried over about a day to this camp. On the right side, you see all the Chinese goods coming via Lhasa and the road to the same place. So you have Kampa traders as wholesalers on the right side and Uyghur traders on the left side, which is very much kind of reviving a trade relations that have been there for a very long time. So these observations, they raised a lot of more fundamental questions of remoteness and connectivity in the Himalayas, but also in the highlands of Asia in general, and actually on a global scale. put as bold and simple as possible, what I want to do with this upcoming five-year project is to rethink in quite fundamental ways seemingly remote peripheries and gain a better conceptual understanding of their role and position in the world. And this talk is somehow a summary of where I stand at the moment. It's taking stock of the things I believe to have learned over the last 4 years, and it's trying to shape them on a rather conceptual level into what I consider to be the starting point for the next 5 years of research. The role and position of remote areas, especially in Highland Asia, was and still is, as I will argue, predominantly understood from the perspective of centers. In the Chinese imperial understanding, for example, this was very explicit. The emperor at the center of the universe, surrounded by his subjects, and further out, barbarians on the fringes of the world. And at times, even different classes of barbarians were distinguished. Yeah, you had the raw barbarians and you had the cooked barbarians, meaning those untouched by the virtue of Chinese civilization and those halfway influenced by it. And the raw barbarians thus had to be cooked, which meant they had to be integrated into the larger realm of superior Chinese civilization. In other words, in a Chinese imperial perspective, remoteness was directly linked to a civilizational hierarchy. Civilizational achievement, on the other hand, was a question of connectivity. Cooking barbarians meant nothing else than including them into the tributary system and granting them the privilege of trade, of exchange, in exchange for alliance and formal submission. The moral underpinnings of British colonial expansion into the highlands of Asia were remarkably similar. But cooking the remote and raw barbarians was more a matter of integrating them into the system of colonial administration, making them harvest tea or timber, and ensuring the British East Indian Company unquestioned rights to trade, a thing for which the British went to war if necessary. This is a drawing from the Young Husband expedition to Tibet in 1904. But even if we look into Russian imperial expansion into Central Asian highlands, we find very similar civilizational undertones. In brief, historically, the role and position of Highland Asia was very much shaped by what could be called an imperial gaze. This gaze was remarkably similar across empires of rather different character. Seen from the centers of power in Beijing, London, or Moscow, remoteness was at once the defining condition of life in the frontiers and the problem that had to be overcome to make them productive. With the collapse of empires and the founding of nation-states in the second half of the 20th century, a more benevolent rhetoric was superimposed onto these older rhetorics of imperial, onto this older imperial gaze. And the civilizational project was rephrased as development. But here too, remoteness and isolation were and still are understood as earmarks and as causes for underdevelopment. This really hasn't changed much. I've yet to see a development report or a project outline that does not emphasize remoteness as basic and defining condition of life in the Himalayas. Development projects almost always aim at forging closer connections with some outside center through infrastructure, through training, through tourism, etc. So the fundamental spatial and civilizational worldview of the knowledgeable center on one side and the ignorant periphery on the other side remained quite similar to the imperial gaze. And then, of course, there is a third perspective, and there always has been a third perspective on the position of remote areas in the Himalayas and elsewhere in the world. It emerged as a critique of both imperial gaze and a modernist development agenda in the 20th century, and it is very closely related to the project of anthropology. It is, namely, the idea that remoteness and isolation protect a place against outside influence. It is the idea of the last sanctuary, the realm of authentic tradition. It is, which is always just about to be coming to an end. And the mission derived from this perspective is, of course, to salvage and document what is left of this world perceived to be just about to disappear. Führer Heimendorf's introduction to a very good book, volume 1981, Asian Highland Societies in Anthropological Perspective, illustrates this stance very well. He writes, Highland societies, the anthropological studies contained in this volume seem to support the view that Highland societies tend to exemplify lifestyles no longer in existence in areas favoring material progress and more rapid social and political changes. Mountains can act as barriers, preserving cultures which, without such physical protection, might have been submerged by civilizations of a very different character. Remoteness as protector against connectivity induced from the outside. The interesting thing is that the very same Fuhr Heimdorf wrote the classic book on Himalayan trade, on Himalayan traders. He was perfectly familiar with the cosmopolitan outreach of trading communities in the Himalayas, and I would be very astonished if he really believed that the traders he described in his work were not favoring material progress. Traders in the Himalayas, they are no less interested in making profits than anywhere else on this planet. But still, remoteness on this level, not connectivity, is taken as the defining condition of Highland societies. Over the past 20, 30 years, the project of ethnographic salvage, as Gruber called it in the 70s, quite sympathetically at that time, this project has morphed into the notion of heritage and the politics surrounding its protection. Issues of rights, of autonomy, of the sharing of benefits define many of the conflicts in the greater Himalayan region today. And such entitlements or such claims to are often couched in notions of cultural authenticity, which themselves, again, are seen as a result of remoteness and isolation. Heritage and assumed authenticity through remoteness are, of course, very directly linked to the tourism potential that comes with it, and thereby to all the questions of connectivity. Discover the last frontier, like this Chinese tourist at Namtso Lake on horseback for 50 yuan per hour. So both ethnographic salvage and its contemporary incarnation as safeguarding of cultural heritage are implicitly projects of connectivity. They are concerned with protecting the remote and authentic through making connections. UNESCO conferences, heritage lists, documentation, films, photography, research, all of these practices are geared towards forging and maintaining global connections. They tap into what I've elsewhere called a globalized moral economy of cultural identity. Now, these are admittedly very, very broad strokes, and you might attack me on each and every one of them, but the point I seek to make is a very simple one. Imperial development and heritage rhetoric, they share a fundamental assessment, namely that remoteness is the defining condition of life in the Himalayas, whereas connectivity, while implicitly part of the practices of imperial governments, of development and of heritage making, remains largely invisible. But at this point, you also may want to counter that there is, of course, a considerable body of literature on connectivity in the Himalayas and other parts of Highland Asia. All the work on Buddhism in Central Asia, all the work on the cosmopolitan Islamic world, on Transmalayan trade, on the countless books on the Silk Roads. So the problem is certainly not the lack of evidence or knowledge about connectivity. The problem is that practices of connectivity are usually kept separate from what is still widely assumed to be the cultural core of life in the high mountains. And this disconnection, I think, is achieved in three particular ways. First, by seeing connectivity as something historical, the old Himalayan trade, the old Silk Roads, etc. Or then, second, by taking it as something induced from the outside, as a result of modernity, as something that foreigners brought in. Or third, as by understanding connectivity as an exception or as an anomaly. The banana pancake trail is not the real Nepal, and the research assistant coming to Europe is not representative for his community, or the transporter smuggling of tiger bones and rhino horns is not the standard, it's the exception. Yeah? The terrorists between Xinjiang and Tajikistan are an anomaly. Yeah? So, in these three ways, this separation, this disconnection is kept up. And this is not just an academic problem. I mean, this defines public knowledge. It shapes policy. It undergirds many a contemporary controversy. Shall a new road be built to this or that valley? Or would it end the presumed authenticity and undermine potential income from tourism? Would it not increase deforestation or maybe over-harvesting of this or that endangered Himalayan herb? The very phrasing of such questions is based on a particular understanding of remoteness and connectivity, in which remoteness is taken as the primordial condition and contemporary connectivity as something transformative, for good or for bad, and introduced from the outside. But connectivity is on a very fundamental level an integral part of daily life in the Himalayas, and I'm sure you all agree. One reason for this is simply linked to the problem of agricultural or agropastoral subsistence. Most of the higher villages and valleys in northern Nepal, and even more so settlements further west from Ladakh to the valleys in northern Pakistan, Afghanistan and Tajikistan, simply cannot produce enough food. Subsistence quotas are frequently below 50%. This means that non-farm income through trade or business, or more recently through development money or through remittances from paid labor in the Gulf or in Russia, is crucial for survival. And as such, low subsistence quotas are nothing new. Trade and this energy of venturing out and doing trade has a very long tradition in the Himalayas. This is something that has been widely acknowledged in the literature, actually. But even here, remoteness usually takes precedence over connectivity when explaining these outward-directed livelihood strategies. The argument made over and over again is that those living in the food-deficient higher valleys are forced to engage in trade because their isolated, rugged, remote valley is not fertile enough to feed them. Francis Lim has in his book on Lantang a perfect example of this. I quote, "Rather than saying that the Langtangpa and other similar people are natural traders, it would be more accurate to describe the situation as enforced trading, for they almost had no choice but to trade in order to survive." This, I think, is really putting the cart before the horse. Wealth in the Himalayas is generally rather associated with trade and business than with agricultural surplus, and I'm sure you will agree on that. But so speaking of enforced trading is a bit like arguing that Wall Street does all the trading stuff because there is not enough space to grow potatoes in Lower Manhattan. It's really kind of the other way around. But this is nothing against Francis Lim's book, and I know him quite well, and he is actually just echoing an argument that has been made over and over again in the by now classical ethnographies on the Himalayas. Of course, one also has to acknowledge that the historical context in which many of these classical Himalayan ethnographies monographs were produced. I mean, it was after the founding of nation states, post-World War II. It was after India and China went to war. And it was after this moment of closure set in the 1960s, where many of these old trade links between China and its neighbors, between Tibet and Nepal, were in decline, in rapid decline. So what the researchers in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s were witnessing was indeed a crisis. It was really very difficult for many of these Himalayan communities to get to terms with the decline of trans-Himalayan trade, the loss of access to winter pastures in Tibet, etc., etc. Of course, agro-pastoral subsistence strategies became a lot more important during this time because trade was no longer there. But even where trade quickly resumed after a short period of closure, which actually happened in quite a few places in northern Nepal, it never regained the importance it had pre-1959, at least not until very recently, the last 10, 15 years. However, I would argue that the largely unreflected association that clearly puts remoteness together with subsistence-oriented farming and connectivity together with anomalies and outside influence goes back much further. J.D. Hooker, a British botanist, went to this village in 1848. This village is called Walung in eastern Nepal. And he wrote about this, but he came to this village and he wrote about this fantastic large mansions in which the people lived, and the elaborate paintings on the mansions, and he tells us about all the talk he hears about the enormous amounts of money that are made in this village, and the taxes paid to the king of Nepal. But then in a sentence later he says, this of course is all rumors, it can't be, because look at this village, there is no agriculture. These poor guys, they even have to import food They can't even live on what they make. There is not one single field in this village. Of course, he didn't know that this was actually really the trading village, and all the people up here, they had extensive lands further down. But, I mean, it was 1848. It is as if he saw it all, but he couldn't believe it, because a remote place like this is supposed to be an agricultural place. It's supposed to be a farming place. It's not, cannot be a rich trading place. There is something I would call a sedentarist metaphysics at work here, to use a term by Lisa Malky. Something that basically sees this close association of traditional authentic culture with the soil, with working the soil, with farming, with agriculture. And I think this hasn't changed much. I mean, I could offer you dozens of examples. The food crisis in Humla nowadays, for example, is always explained not by the collapse of trade that happened quite recently in Humla, like around the turn of the millennium, but by the very fact that the farmers just don't know enough about good practices. They are too remote, too isolated, and then there is a bit of climate change on top of it. And what we need to do is training. We have to educate them on using better seeds and better farming techniques and stuff like that. Not a word. I've really scanned many of these development reports, and I've not read a word on the association of the food crisis in Humla and the collapse of trade that actually brought in food from the south until around 2000. So connectivity is not understood as inherently at the core of everyday life in remote Himalayan areas. And connectivity is hardly ever understood in relation to remoteness. This, I believe, is a bias we absolutely need to leave behind. So my working hypothesis is very simple. Remoteness and connectivity, they are not two separate phenomena. They belong together. They even condition each other in particular ways. They form a nexus. And my aim over the next 5 years of research or so is to better understand and describe this nexus of remoteness and connectivity. On a certain level, this is obvious and almost banal. I mean, in places as far away from urban centers, connections are certainly less numerous. But the ones that exist, they tend to be extremely important. In remote places, you often find people obsessed with connectivity. And this obsession, of course, ties in with whatever opportunity arises. Now, let me be clear about one thing. I'm not trying to convince you that agriculture is not important, or that remoteness is not real, or that all our common knowledge about the Himalayas is just an Orientalist fantasy that needs to be deconstructed. Not at all. Remoteness really is an undeniable dimension of reality in the Himalayas. And people constantly complain about it. It's too far, it's too expensive, and so on and so on. And remoteness is really linked to a variety of problems locally. Also, there is this tale of the hidden valley, of the mythical hidden valley, the Beyul, which is so important in the Himalayas. These hidden valleys, these Beyul, are often called, they afford protection in times of need. And this certainly reflects the historical reality, namely that in the Himalayas, in fact, in most of the highlands of Asia, there have been times where they served as refuge. The rise of the Mughal Empire in India, the Qing Dynasty in China, but also the rise of Gelug power in Tibet, all sent waves of refugees to the Rajput Mountain peripheries. So this notion of seeking refuge has recently gained a lot of attention with James Scott's book, The Art of Not Being Governed. Scott's thesis, put simply, is that Zomia, or the highlands of the Southeast Asian massif, have provided refuge for those consciously opting out of state rule. The high taxes, the corvée obligations, the diseases made people retreat voluntarily to the mountains, in order to enjoy the relative freedom and the relatively egalitarian societies in the hills. Despite all the storm of criticism that Scott's book is facing and attracting, I think he makes an important point. The Art of Not Being Governed really is a radical departure from Sino or Eurocentric perspectives, and it really tries to think the dynamics between valley and hill from the vantage point of the latter. However, Scott's Zomia thesis is also a version of this refuge through remoteness narrative. And as such, it fundamentally underestimates the role of connectivity in these seemingly remote areas. Besides refuge, a second motivation brought and continues to bring people to the mountains and hills, namely the promise of fortune. Fortune, profiting from a boom in this or that natural resource, or positioning oneself in relation to the economy such a resource creates, this clearly shaped the social geography of wealth in the Himalayas to a great extent. There are many, many, many examples for this. Seeking refuge emphasizes remoteness, but seeking fortune, on the other hand, emphasizes connectivity. Let me give you a contemporary example of the nexus of remoteness and connectivity against the background of such a resource boom, namely the boom in Satwa, Paris Polyfilla. Currently, the demand for this herb, for the root of this herb, is very high in China, where the Satwa is used for a variety of medicinal purposes. Satwa is found in many areas in Nepal, between 2,000 and 3,000 meters, but the local resources simply cannot meet demand. When I was in Humla in western Nepal in October 2012, I witnessed this craze around me. Everybody around me seemed to be getting into the Satwa business. A Chinese entrepreneur on the other side of the border had basically promised to buy whatever Satwa he could find. And soon Satwa was being imported to Humla in order to sell to China. Now you have to know that there is no road to Humla. You have to fly things into Humla in order to sell it to China for about $1 or $1.50 per kg. And in October 2012, there was like plane after plane landing in this mountain airport in Simikot, full of Satwa herbs, imported from Nepalganj, imported from Delhi, even afterwards imported from Pakistan, channeled through this route, put on these mules and carried up 6 days to the Tibetan border, which costs also an enormous lot of money, and sold to a Chinese entrepreneur there. Air freight and mule transport are very costly, and the question really is, why a herb is channeled through Humla instead of being transported on what would be a much easier route? I mean, there are like roads that lead from Nepal to Tibet, or there are roads from Pakistan to China that would cost a fraction of this route. And I think this is really one of these links between remoteness and connectivity. Satwa is not on an endangered species list. It's not a CITES listed. And you can actually, in principle, trade it legally. However, the import of medicinal herbs into China is really a hassle. It's very, very difficult. And it demands plant quarantine and things like that. And a remote crossing like the one in Humla suddenly was a very good option, because there was much less scrutiny on this. There seems to have been a working arrangement between a low-level customs official and all these traders. And this allowed for cheap and simplified import procedures. And this apparently trumped all the financial benefits of shipping Satwa via one of the main routes. So remoteness in this context of kind of China's global rise, the open borders, but at the same time like more control along the borders. Remoteness became some sort of asset that directly boosted connectivity. Like all these little mountain crossings now attract all sorts of things that are channeled through them. And this, of course, is only possible because Humla at the core has a long history as a trading society, and all these people are so focused on opportunities and trading opportunities that within like a month this entire infrastructure and logistics was built up, and people started getting money to pay for flights and within a very short time this old trade route kind of was totally geared up to become the focus of such a crazy global flow between South Asia and China. When I presented some of these observations about the importance of connectivity and in seemingly remote areas at another talk about a year ago, there were a few cultural studies people in the audience, and their reaction was Of course it is like this. I mean, how could anybody assume it isn't like this? The world is connectivity, and what you're telling us is, of course, nothing new. I mean, they asked me if I'd never heard of things like flows or networks and entangled spaces, and I replied somewhat clumsily at that time that anthropology might indeed have missed some of the discipline-changing turns over the past decades, but that replacing these old imaginaries of remote peripheries just with fancy new and also rather generic talk of flows, networks, and connected spaces doesn't do much to explain such contemporary processes that I'm observing. But then I started thinking about these notions very hard. I mean, flow, network, space are really, I think, that the key terms that have been used in the attempt to understand globalization over the last 20 years, since the 90s. They've become the most dominant notions of all these debates about globalization and contemporary connectivity. And of course, there is lots and lots of work. I mean, starting with Arjun Abadarai, with Ulf Hannes, with Doreen Massey, that coined these terms in brilliant ways. And this has been an enormously, enormously productive field of study, of course. This is not the place to kind of go into this discussion of where these terms come from and how they relate to each other. But the interesting thing I find is that actually all these terms, flow, network, and space, they were conceived on the turf of a conceptual reflection of globalization in urban spaces. They almost always come out of people interested in urban sociology, urban anthropology. So the sprawling urban center of the 21st century is really the turf from where these terms grow. And consider for a moment how different this is from, let's say, structuralism or functionalism, that were born and bred within an intensive engagement with non-urban and mostly remote settings. So the study of globalization has so far largely focused on urban centers. And what I'm trying to do is to study globalization not from the centers and not even from below, as many people have suggested recently, but rather from the margins. The problem is that the conceptual tools at hand, flow, network, space, they somehow fail to capture what is going on. Flow, network, and space have helped create a certain image of connectivity in which moving goods and people from place to place is primarily a matter of transport, of logistics. It's largely conditioned by socioeconomic factors, by regimes of control. And this is, again, in complete contrast to what, like, imperial gaze of Russian, British, or Chinese flavor suggested. It is also in complete contrast to what ethnographic salvage suggested, namely that the rugged mountains had the power to shield Highland Asian communities off from outside influence. Contemporary studies of flows and networks and spaces, they tend to have very little regard for the physical aspects of terrain and topography. They're made for a flat world. In the mountains of Highland Asia, however, connectivity is inherently linked to the question of terrain. You have deep gorges, you have mountain passes, highland deserts. All of this makes certain routes more favorable than others, and certain places more out of the way. Landslides and snowfall cut off regions for considerable periods of time. Terrain and environment directly affect connectivity. Things and people neither flow nor hop from place to place. They really move along specific paths through terrain. Tim Ingold's critique of space is relevant in this respect. He argues in a very similar way that movement follows lines rather than crosses spaces. And the result is rather a meshwork of lines than a network. However, Ingold's concept of wayfaring along lines that form a meshwork is based on his observations in the Arctic, in the open landscapes of the Arctic, where every movement of every animal or human being leaves a track. And you have these meshworks that are almost visible, presented in front of you. In Highland Asia, however, topography has a different influence on mobility. The high mountain passes may neither shield the valleys off from outside influence, nor is there any functional link between environment and culture. The mountains, I mean, there are so many different cultural forms and cultures and religions in the greater Himalayas that there is really no direct link between topography and whatever you want to call culture. But the mountains do one thing for sure. They define where people walk. The topography of Highland Asia, the valleys and passes, they bundle exchange along certain pathways, as I call them. Old trade routes follow these pathways. New roads are built along these pathways. Pipelines are built along these pathways. These pathways, they have a very long history, and they are still extremely relevant. They're engraved in terrain. These pathways, they shape connectivity in Highland Asia. They bundle connections. In the Satwa example before, it is no coincidence that trade through Humla followed a route used for centuries, if not millennia, despite the fact that there is like 22,000 kilometers of mainly open, unfenced borders between China and the rest of the world. Pathways are good to think with for several reasons. First, they structure what is otherwise imagined as a uniform frontier space. Pathways highlight spatial asymmetries and thereby facilitate a critical reflection on relations within a given region. Pathways create somehow their own hinterlands, areas not oriented towards a center but towards a pathway. And these dynamics between pathways and their hinterlands is rather different from the dynamics between urban centers and peripheries. But second, the notion of pathway also raises the question of relations between regions of Highland Asia or of the greater Himalayan region. Such relations are relevant, for example, when a road or a pipeline is built along one pathway but not along the other one, or when one border crossing becomes the target of increased scrutiny, or when one pathway is closed because of snow or landslides or whatever. So there are dozens of historical and contemporary examples for this dynamic between different pathways and the regions surrounding them. And the Satwa story is just that. I mean, you have these major pathways that have perfect roads and you could use, but they're not used because of greater scrutiny, or that's at least what I think. So, to conclude this rather admittedly crude first sketch of the nexus of remoteness and connectivity, let me summarize the two axes of inquiry I've so far identified as potentially useful. The first axis is this issue of mobility, of in and out migration, the interplay of fortune, of refuge. I take James Scott's Somia thesis, which he actually explicitly limits to the era pre-World War II, and I transpond it. Let's transpond the underlying dynamics into the contemporary world in which remoteness has become an asset in different ways. I suspect that today the art of not being governed is very often an art of actually being governed, just not too much or not too strictly. And the second axis of inquiry is concerned with socio-spatial relations within and between different areas in the greater Himalayan region. The notion of pathways and Ingold's ideas about lines, meshworks, and wayfaring are the starting point to critically reflect the dominant concepts in the study of globalization. The aim of both these axes is to work towards a better conceptual grasp of globalization from the margins. And I bet that this nexus of remoteness and connectivity in the Himalayas has many similarities with similar nexuses elsewhere. But this is already thinking far beyond what I'm starting to do now, and this is also the end of my talk and hopefully the beginning of a discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This was great, and I'm sure there are plenty of questions. The floor is open. Yes.
Thanks for this talk. I admit I have some critical questions, perhaps. And one of the aspects of what you mentioned was this new routes and connections and roads follow often old pathways, historic pathways. I mean, I could present a large number of counterexamples. And if you look, for example, you will have this area, maybe in the Sutlej Valley, the old roads and the pathways, that's completely different from what we see nowadays. For example, the old pathways you will never find, the old places when you go on the road nowadays. And this, the old British Hindustan road, which is now leading up to the border, this is an imperial project, and that can be continued perhaps in the future, but this is something completely different from the old pattern that we find. So, and I think also in other areas, I mean, I'm not sure if this really works actually everywhere. Maybe in some cases, yes, and you mentioned a few perhaps, but I would be skeptical as a general concept if that works.
Should I respond?
Sure.
I mean, you would have to count in the end to see if what is true or not. But I would say further down, this is much more true. But as soon as you come to the higher areas of the Himalayas or the higher areas of Central Asia, then you really indeed have most of the new roads have been built long old tracks. I mean, this is. If you go from in Nepal from east to west, and then it's almost, I mean, each and everyone follows this pattern. Sometimes, of course, there is a huge shift in importance. For example, Walung in eastern Nepal was the main route between Shikatse and South Asia before the Young Husband expedition kind of opened the Chumbi Valley through Sikkim as a major trade route. And nowadays, Walung is still used as a trade route. It's booming. It's booming for all kinds of things. But the big traffic goes through the Arun Valley, which is just west of it, which used to be a very minor trade route before. Why? Because the Chinese road makes this little turn, and the road head on the Chinese side is very close to the border in Kimatanka, and so these changes of weight of pathways, this is certainly exactly what I'm trying to get at. So if you look in you can look at similar things in Pakistan. The Karakoram Highway was not built along one of the major trade routes. You can see the same thing in India. It's a bit different because, of course, since it's still not. I mean, you have these three halfway the Nathula, and then you have these two other passes that are somewhat open, within limits in Uttaranchal. But in Pakistan, in Central Asia, in Nepal, I think the majority of these routes are really, really exactly worked out like this. In Humla, it was the same thing. I mean, the major trade route probably was much more going through the Limi Valley and not through along the Kanali. Difficult to say, at different times, different weights. In Mustang, it's clearly the case. In Kirong, it's clearly the case. Along the Friendship Highway, Nyalam, it's clearly the case. In Dolpa, Mayamla was probably the main trade route. You have a road that goes to the border there. It's also becoming the main route for Yatsugumba. Further west, the Tsum Valley was one of the side routes of the Kirong Way, which is again in the same dynamic, becoming important again. I mean, we would really have to list them all and see what are the counterexamples, and would they really not fit into a dynamic between different pathways? So I am. I'm sorry, I can't accept the criticism before we sit together, but I really like to do that.
First, André Dinich.
Yes, thank you. I think it is a good and productive contribution to current debates to connect and combine an old Oxford idea, an Adonis.
Yes, thank you.
With an old Manchester idea, namely Max Gluckman's connectivity and networks, and to make something new out of this, that's, I think, useful, really. Although, I think I also heard your caveat built in, that one shouldn't reify these two concepts per se, and that had already been a criticism against Edwin Audinot's idea of remoteness, where his critiques pointed out that remoteness means different things in different constellations at historical junctures. And of course that networks also change according to local situations. But still I agree that combining these two is helpful if we keep these earlier criticisms against Gluckman and against Audinot in mind. And I also think that you're quite right that in the course of globalization studies, where these older ideas had been reactivated, much of the more sweeping rhetorics permanently spoke of flows and networks in ways that didn't differentiate the ideas anymore. But if you look at networks more closely, that caveat I would like to add, some of what you have been, I think, throwing in a justified way against some of the exaggerated rhetorics of globalization parlance, if you look at it more closely, is already part and parcel of network methodologies, because you can't properly work on the ground with network methodologies without of course assuming from the outset that in a given terrain under given circumstances there will be fewer connections between various sites under given geographical and technological etc. conditions than if you ask the same question of another terrain under different historical conditions. So there, when it comes to the methodology of network analysis, I would ask you to be a bit more restrained, because I think much of more differentiated network analysis already
does that.
Has said many of the things that you have been saying today in relation to network analysis.
Yes, I mean, it's a bit like the conflict between Dorian Massey and Tim Ingold on the notion of space. I mean, she writes this book for space, he writes against space, and actually it's very similar. I mean, the ground they cover is not that different. Yeah. I make a very bold point here. I'm totally aware of this. But what I want to stress is that in terms of methodology, maybe I'm wrong, but in terms of methodology of trying to analyze these networks, people have usually focused on nodes. They have been basically, on a very practical level, you go and sit in the nodes, and then you try to see who comes, who goes, what flows, what goes there. What has been, I mean, this is also very much coming out of a certain research ethics in anthropology, especially where you go to a certain place and you sit there, you stay put until you start slowly how things work. And this is less. I mean, many of the Himalayan ethnographies, they talk about trade and traders, but they only see them coming and going. They don't follow them. So what I would say, in terms of methodology, or one of them in this grandiose ERC project that I formulated, one of the things that we put in there is what we want to do is we want to do something like co-itinerant ethnography. We need to follow people on the way. And I've been doing that with traders, and it's really very, very productive, because only when you actually really travel with people, move from place to place, share a taxi, share a truck, then you start realizing how that it's not just dots in a network that are somehow connected, but most of what is ethnographically relevant, or what makes this world, is actually happens on the way, along the ways. So this is one of the methodological innovations I'd like to push. Yeah.
I think that's a good one.
Your turn.
Yeah, thanks for your talk. I found that very, very interesting for my own research. Some of your claims match my fieldwork experiences in Upper Assam, and some do not. And it would need to count things by items. But I didn't like your monolithic treatment of trade.
Yes.
Of course, it's for the sake of the frame here. You already mentioned what difference it makes to follow people or sit in a node. I think if we go down into a concrete methodology, then it gets differentiated enough. So it makes also a huge difference whether you follow the traders or the goods, for example. Just to add this more.
But can you be a little more specific on what you didn't like about the monolithic trade? I mean, yes,
you
accept
always,
that.
You always said trade only and,
yes.
and didn't differentiate. Now
between what, for example?
Now you said the difference between looking at the nodes or looking at the traders.
Yes.
So that's a useful distinction, I find. And also, as I just added, following either goods or traders does make a difference.
Mm.
How far does a trader bring his goods?
Mm.
Does he bring it from producer to consumer, or how far in between, and how many traders are in between?
Yes.
And their community relations on the ways. That may be very different.
Very different. I mean, there is excellent work being done, and I exaggerate things clearly in order to make the point. But yeah, for example, the work of Magnus Marstens is excellent in this respect, where he basically follows Afghan traders from the large markets in China to the markets in Ukraine and follows all the goods and the traders on this way, so this idea. And this is really something that has been extremely inspirational for this project. All the different forms of trade, of exchange, of credit, of debt, of all the social relations linked to it, that's exactly the sort of ethnographic material I am looking at. For this talk, I just threw it all into one bucket, and I call it connectivity, and I call it remoteness. Of course, these are very broad, vague terms, but what I really think is I do this for this one purpose, namely to highlight that I honestly believe that these two things haven't been thought together in all respects. I mean, I can give you not only in trade, think about things like polyandric marriages in the Himalayas. They've always been explained by ways of saying that. In agricultural ways, saying that basically it doesn't split the family land if you have all the brothers marrying one sister, one woman, so the land isn't split and you don't have these little parcels of land, so it's a good investment in family, especially if you have water rights that can't be split and. Nancy Levin made this argument, Goldstein made this argument. Almost everybody who worked on this sort of thing put this in the larger framework of agricultural subsistence. Nobody has looked at it in terms of... and the stories I hear is always... I mean, the big advantage of that is the more brothers, the more you can send abroad to bring in some fortunes. The woman who married five, she has the best jewelry, because three of them... You always need one who does the farm, and you need one who looks after the animals. But if you have three more venturing out and doing trade, chances are much higher you get somewhere. So this aspect, for example, of connectivity has always been kind of kept out.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. And I think bringing these things together can really serve to relook in a sympathetic but critical way into much of the material that has been written on the Himalayas, on what I call Highland Asia. It's again a silly term, but on the greater Himalayan region. So, yeah.
Paula?
You know, methodology, harking back to gentleman over there who's saying, I totally with you when you say that nothing of this scope has been done for Central Asia, and I have in mind Russian and Chinese to understand. I would dispute the methodological innovation's claim in the sense that going back to turf wars between Oxford and Cambridge, I have in mind the corrupting sea, for example, Horden and Purcell, again, a forceful critique against sitting in the node from an historical perspective. And in talking about pathways, Judith Schiele's.
Yeah, I love the book.
Yeah, so there is no methodological innovation. I mean, I do have sympathy for your work, but we end up by applying, and there's nothing wrong with that, what Judith Schiele has been doing, because she has not been sitting in the notes.
No, she's
been
very
much. She
has been
walking, and now I don't remember, but there was a guy working at the Bicocca University in Milan with Fabietti, hopping from truck to another in Somaliland, and again, it was at Max Planck in Halle. So, again, I have wonderful talk, and there's nothing has been done in Central Asia in terms of pathways, but pathways have been described in Algerian Touat. And in terms of magnitude, I mean, the corrupted sea can cover what you have been telling us.
Yes, I'm really standing on the shoulders of giants here. That's absolutely true, and I don't claim to be completely innovative. Any of this is absolutely new. No, I mean. And a series of PhDs have recently been done that actually do what I now call co-itinerant ethnography, from Till Mostoglianski on the Pamir Highway to Alessandro Ripa on the Karakoram Highway and then lots. The Sahara has been extremely productive terrain for conceptual innovation in anthropology recently. Judith Schiele, but also people like Ruben Anderson, for example. I mean, this is exactly the sort of stuff I would like to do in the Highlands of Asia. No, and Magnus, of course. Yes. No, I mean, this is where I feel home. This is exactly the So what I do here is I'm not writing against them, or I'm not trying to kind of, but I'm trying to take all of this and put it somehow in a bigger perspective, and I think that to really think about this nexus of these different forces of remoteness and connectivity is my, or could be my modest contribution to this to this debate, because I don't think that anybody has really gone into that too much. Maybe I'm wrong, but not of the things I've read. Yeah. I mean, there has been a lot. I mean, most of the things about connectivity that have been written are excellent historical monographs on maritime connectivity. I mean, starting with all these big history books, with Eising Ho, with Abu Lugot, that's basically where, going back to Sheldon Pollock and the idea of the Sanskrit cosmopolis, and that's basically one of the, this is exactly the stuff we've been reading it with Prasenjitwara in Singapore. I mean, much of this idea of remoteness and connectivity comes out of a reading group with Prasenjitwara in Singapore on the historical sociology of Asian connections. So the entire research agenda of inter-Asian connections, this is, I mean, I come out of this thing, I took it from everywhere, of course.
Leonardo.
Okay. First, I have to apologize for not having been here since the beginning of your talk, so I might have lost something on the way. If that's the case, I'm sorry. But I want to address something. I think that's the same thing that has been going around on the table, but from about a different topic. Let's say if you go even further up in a more abstract level instead of the more practical level, you mentioned that ideas such as fluxes, networks, and space and so on have been all coming from urban studies of urban anthropology in general and so on, and that you don't want to do something that comes even from below as others did and so on, but you then you place yourself as, you know, what I wanted to study is marginality in a sense. And what I would argue is that, well, anthropology somehow has been dealing with the marginal as the subject, as its subject forever. Historically speaking. Mm. And of course then when you deal with network studies and so on, you had a shift to urban studies exactly to try to be more symmetric in that sense. And yet I don't ever think that we lost this favoritism for marginality. And so some of the works that I'm just thinking about marginality and globalization right now are from Vina Das, from Deborah Poole, from Talal Assad. So in that regard, how is that choice is different from them?
Mm. I'm not talking about marginality, but more like spatially from the margins. I mean marginality.
Yeah, but
Vina,
what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but I mean Vina Das and Gujarat, for example, that's more a story of marginality in a social way, not so much in a social spatial way, but not so much at the peripheries of empire or the peripheries of nation states.
Peripheries of empires, of the states are built and maintained in peripheral.
Yes, on that level. Yes, yeah. Yes, it depends on yeah. But. Now I've got what I wanted to say. This was only a sidetrack. What was the core of your question, Vin?
How is that your treatment of marginality is different than of those authors, for example?
Mm. I don't use the word marginality, really.
Okay.
It's. I mean, but one of the things I'm trying to get. I still use the words margin and center in order to make a point, but what I'm really trying to do is to look into these regions in the highlands of Asia, not from the perspective of a center, but from the perspective of these places that are now quite at the peripheries of nation states. So I'm much more inspired by the writings of, for example, David Ludden or people like Willem van Schendel, who've been arguing for quite some time now that we have a certain blindness along the fringes of area studies and the fringes of studies that are based within nation states. Yeah? And the idea of looking not into marginality as a topic, but into an era that has been so much at the edge or at the margin of the formation of nation states in the 20th century and at the frontiers of empires in the 19th century in a more comparative, larger perspective. This is what I'm trying to do. This is not radically new. Yeah, this is basically trying to fill what Andreas Winmar has written this influential article together with Nina Gluck.
Schiller.
Yeah, Glick Schiller on the methodological nationalism and Ulrich Beck, who just died in Munich, he tried to take this up and think ways of transcending methodological nationalism and think beyond it. And so coming from that side, coming from and really finding it quite brilliant what Willem van Schendel says about the geographies of ignorance along the margins of nation states and disciplines and the need to transcend them and to think things together we've seen separate. That's regionally why I think looking at the highlands of Asia as one thing is important and yeah. Marginality as topic, I haven't really. It's not in the center of what I'm trying to do, really. Yeah.
Eva.
Yeah, thank you so much. I enjoyed your talk a lot and gave me really something to chew on. I have two questions. Mm. So you said, okay, when you were sitting in Singapore, of course, you got into all these historic networks that ran across the sea. But did you also look into island studies? Because the question of remoteness and connection is very strong there. That's more where I come from. So that is one question. Did you get any influence here? I'm thinking, for example,
like Pacific studies, the Sea of Islands,
and also the nation state, the hinterland, and islands. There is a huge number of publications for years, and of course you can go back to Charles Darwin and the island as the laboratory and the remote area as the production of big theories and methodologies, right? So that was one question. And the second question, when you talked about Tim Ingold and pathways, I was wondering if you also tried out Anat Singh's channels, and where do you see the differences? Because for me, if you look with Anat Singh on the channel, the pathway might change. So one valley might be blocked, but the flow of goods has to be secured. So we will take another pathway around. I think she works with this idea of a river that carves its bed every year after the snow melting in a different way. So I was wondering if you also tried out the channels and the pathways.
Let me start with Anat Singh and then go back to to the island studies, and maybe you have to cue me on that island studies again if I forget. But with Anat Singh, I was reading Friction in a tent on 4,000 meters, and I found it genius. And the idea of the creation of a resource frontier, like this entire narrative of what happens with wood being locked in Kalimantan, and the entire industry that kind of gets into these social structures and into these spaces. I mean, this is really, and I saw so many parallels. Anat Singh says brilliantly that the logging road, the logging road is one of these almost metaphorical things she highlights. And the quality of the logging road is that it leads nowhere. They always indeed lead nowhere. And that's what she writes. Because they're used, they're made, the wood is taken out, the next one. And the quality of Himalayan pathways is that they lead somewhere. And they've been leading to places for a very long time. There have been times where they were not important, and the weights are constantly shifting, but pathways lead somewhere. The creation of resource frontiers, and kind of what she calls frontier capitalism, this is very much the world of the Satwa boom is totally an example of a resource frontier being created, and of resource capitalism and the logic of resource capitalism. But then again, it's really interesting that I've been trying to find out how long people have really worked with money and banks and stuff, and this seems to be going back much longer than we would assume. It was so interesting. I was walking for a few days once by chance, we met with a couple of Nepali guys from an NGO trying to do training on microfinance credit management in Limi, at the border to China, in northwestern Nepal. 5-6 days walking from the next airport. So these poor guys went up there and tried to educate people on how to manage finance, microfinance credit management with flip charts and stuff. And it was so difficult. They came into the village and they only could do that with women, because that was kind of, the NGO only paid for training women, not men. But it was so difficult because it was the main time where, people just came back, had just come back from working for 2-3 months on the Chinese side, on the construction sites to develop Western China, and they were just about going to get the animals down. Autumn trade was beginning. Nobody had time for training. Nobody had time for training. And nobody had ever taken out a microcredit loan that has a 3%. I mean, the interest rates are horrendous, yeah? But they all have bank accounts. They invest in in Hong Kong Stock Exchange. They are totally fluent capitalists, and they've been that for a very long time. Yeah? So this mismatch is something that is really interesting for me. In Anat Singh's narrative, it's very much capitalism is something that is introduced from the outside. If I look at the all these shrewd traders of whatever is not totally legal in the Himalayas, I have the impression that there is, okay, you'll shoot me for this, but there is something like primordial capitalism or something like, I mean, the roots of being totally, totally business-oriented and at the same time totally Buddhist by being a jindak and giving the money to the monastery afterwards. But the orientation towards making money, profit, is something that I don't think is introduced from the outside. And I'm not sure if you can say that about Kalimantan. So, Anna Tsing, interestingly enough, she doesn't come back to that very often in the Matsutake project, the resource frontier. Yeah, she sort of left the channels. Not totally. I mean, it's still channels, it's this enormous logistics and stuff, but it's sort of a... Yeah. I mean, there she's very inspired by Deleuze Guattari and the Rhizome and that stuff. And the method is object, and object is our research. Yeah. So So she kind of left this a bit, I think. The Sea of Islands is something that is very, very new to me, and this is a literature I hardly know. We have people in Munich now that work on the Pacific and on the basically all these Pacific linkages, and the idea is to collaborate more closely. I think it's totally interesting to compare and think things together, but what I also think is that the land makes a difference. I mean, sea and ports and the Mediterranean, Brodel, this is really something that works along, that offers us an awful lot of inspiration to think larger spaces, but works with different mechanics because of the main routes of exchange are just sea. Mm-hmm. Is that an answer?
I just was wondering if you also take some inspiration from this kind of stuff.
Yeah. I might have to ask
I'm
you.
I'm looking for the name of a colleague, but I cannot come across it. He wrote this very inspiring book, Fairy Tales, and he rode along with the fairies.
Yeah.
So he did exactly what you're looking for in British Columbia and describes how the whole communities are now on fairy timetables, yeah. So they know exactly when to get ready, and then they produce their whole life around the timetable of the fairies, and then the fairy company just makes a change in the timetable and what that means for the whole people there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it might be inspiring in some parts.
I'll have to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. It's not something I know.
Yeah, I have to look it up. But
okay.
Any more questions? Maybe I'll ask the last one. It's a more practical question, actually. And it's really a question, not a critique. On the one hand, you have this quite abstract concept, remoteness and connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you have this extremely locally specific settings over a huge landmass. I mean, Highland Asia, huge. 22,000 kilometers of China's borders or whatever. So on the one hand, I'm interested in what does your work plan look like? How you're going to arrange that on the one hand in terms of actual research and allotment of human resources, the other researchers on your project, and also how you will connect your ethnographic data and your insights from these highly specific local places where indeed trade means something else maybe in Humla than it does in Afghanistan or something. I don't know. How do you connect all of these? Do you have some kind of intermediate level a concept or something that's a step below remoteness and connectivity to bring all that together under one kind of what connects all of these? How will you connect all of your ethnographic insights?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I knew, if I knew on a practical level, at the moment I don't. I mean, the concept is rather simple. We will be four people. Mm-hmm. We have four primary transnational settings throughout this region. We'll be looking at not each person one thing, but at each person at least two things. So we'll have overlapping fieldwork. We'll have expertise that covers more than one region. We'll have planned field meetings also with research assistants from the different places that come along, so that everybody sort of knows the context of the other places. Trying to ensure that this is going to be woven together tightly from the beginning. We have another four transnational research settings as alternatives, because chances are very high that one doesn't work out, or two or three. This is all very volatile. We don't have an intermediary concept yet towards which we would be working. The idea of Highland Asia in the world is very broad, but also something that has been resonating with the various projects that the people also bring in. There's somebody working on more on religious networks. There is somebody working on roads and road construction. There's somebody working on really petty trade and traders and small scale interactions and long distance things. But we haven't really started yet. I mean, that's a big question of how to bring it together. Hopefully we'll produce... Well, no, that's too specific now. That's about what I can say without kind of leaping ahead too much.
Okay. I think let's call it a day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Habt ihr das nicht gemacht?
Doch.